Part 25, Chapter 3. As Johnny left his room, he saw that the underground passage also led past the hospital. Although his intention had been to go out to the cone where the platform was, concern about the wounded of the raiding party halted him by that door. A clatter was coming from the place. The click of bolts being cocked and the slap of slings. Arms? He stepped inside the door. There were about 30 beds, and over half of them were occupied. But two Chinese, whose armbands showed they were from the armory, had a dolly with assorted weaponry, and they were passing out blast rifles, AK-47s with thermite ammunition, and handguns to the wounded Scots. A gray-haired Scot nurse came up to Johnny. She obviously did not approve of this commotion in her ward. Then she recognized Johnny and choked back whatever she was about to say, probably to tell him to get out. Johnny had been counting.
There's 13 in here from the raiding party and two gunners. Are there any more?
The two lads with concussions are in surgery,
said the nurse.
Dr. McKendrick says their operations went well and they'll be fine. Are you supposed to be up, McTyler?
By now, one of the injured Scots had seen Johnny at the door and barked his name.
Johnny!
Johnny had been about to go from bed to bed with apologies. It appeared there were 17 casualties out of the raiding party of 31. No, 18, including himself. Heavy. These men were badly bruised. Black eyes predominated. Several broken limbs. He felt that better planning could have averted this. But the other Scots had seen him, and they began to put up a yell. Sounded like...
Scotland we pray!
They were sitting up and yelling. Nothing wrong with their morale. Suddenly Johnny realized that these lads had slaughtered the Brigantes and settled the blood feud of Scotland. They were victors. Their injuries were badges of honor. They would be heroes to the whole Scottish nation. No apologies needed here. He tried to shout into the din and then simply saluted them and, with a smile and wave, withdrew. He could hear loudspeakers outside playing solemn religious music to prevent infrabeam surveillance. He came out of the passage from the bunkers and gazed into the bowl. The daylight was made murky from drifting smoke. The slight odor of the atmosphere armor at stage 3 mixed with charcoal's tang. The bowl seemed unusually crowded. It was 1,000 feet in diameter at the level of its floor. Before, he had thought that was a lot of space. About 750,000 square feet, he had guessed. But it did seem crowded now. The pagoda structure in the center extended well beyond the platform on all sides. All around the bowl, with the pagoda at its center, was a sort of wide, paved road. When he had seen it before, it had almost been deserted. Over there to the right were two Italian-Swiss electricians rigging more wires into some bunkers. A German and a Swiss pilot were sorting out a dolly load of air masks. Near to hand, a Scot officer was giving some instructions to a Russian soldier. Way over to the left, a group of Swedish soldiers were sorting out ammunition on a dolly. There, just coming out of a passage which must lead outside, were two Sherpa hunters pushing a dolly load of African buffalo meat toward what must be a kitchen. Here and there, a Buddhist communicator was moving with a floating wok from one bunker to another. And scattered all about, along the inner bank, were Chinese families and their children and belongings. On one of the big posts which held up the pagoda roof, the Chinese had hung tribal shields representing the remaining tribes of Earth. A truly international scene. The peoples of Earth.